Fast forward all of these years, and what you see today is, the massive fruition of that original project. When we look around and see the types of predictive policing technologies and facial recognition technologies and so forth. And so this has been that 50 plus year project begun at that moment when civil rights and development of computing had that first clash.
That was Charlton McElwain, Professor of Media at New York University and our guest today on digital mindfulness. Charlton focuses his academic work on the intersections between race, digital media, and racial justice activism, and he's also the founder of the Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies. In this episode, we discuss his new book, Black Software, The Internet and Racial Justice. And in this fascinating talk, Charlton highlights the roots of the racial justice movement online, why the Black Lives Matter movement is more than 50 years in the making, and how power structures manifest online. But before we start, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. In this podcast, we bring together thought leaders focusing on responsible innovation in all its guises, from ethical technologies to digital well-being. We're focused on the advancement of responsible and sustainable innovation, and the best place to take a deeper dive on these fascinating topics is by going to our website or meeting us in person at one of our events, where we bring together the global community to discuss advancements in responsible and sustainable innovation. I hope you enjoy this episode with Charlton McElwain. Well, thank you so much for being here with me on Digital Mindfulness. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. I'm really looking forward to finding out much more about the book that we've just released and digging much more into the overall thesis, because it's absolutely fascinating. So Charlton, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if, first of all, if you could just introduce yourself to the audience. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your journey to be working in technology and race and society, and in particular, how this book came about.
Absolutely. I've had about a 20-year career as a professor, in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. For much of the first part of my career, my research and my teaching and so forth was really centered around issues of race and media and electoral politics, political campaigns and such. And about 8 to 10 years ago, I started to do work and become much more interested in the internet, on digital media technology, and similarly, its intersections with issues of race and racial justice. As I started to think about what ultimately became this book, that started with my attempt to, my desire to understand the movement that we know as Black Lives Matter. A movement that was powerful both in the United States and across the world. And in fact, I recall taking a trip not long after Ferguson and Michael Brown, who got shot and killed in that instance, and the hashtag Black Lives Matter that was very much a part of that, and going to one to Germany and the other to London, and getting off the plane and seeing folks across Europe really with that hashtag and talking about Black Lives Matter and varying forms of solidarity with that movement. So I wanted to understand Black Lives Matter. How did these folks accomplish what they accomplished, which was not a small feat, to get the U.S., to get the world, their attention, again, on issues of race, racial inequality, and particularly the issue about how Black people are treated at the hands of the criminal justice system. And more specifically, I was interested in how did folks leverage and use digital media technology, platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Google, etc., to really further their cause. So that's where this journey began, me trying to understand and provide some explanation for the digital roots of Black Lives Matter. And ultimately, the book turned into much, much more.
I imagine that when you started researching the book, that there wasn't much grist for the mill in terms of an academic canon on this topic. Would I be right in saying that?
There wasn't at all. You're exactly right. And I was a little surprised. I mean, you know, race and racial issues are no small issues, nor is the internet that had been, you know, around for a while and digital media technology for even longer. So I figured there would be much more of a literature when I transitioned there, but I didn't find what I thought I would find. What I did find was fairly superficial in a way that it talked about simply representation. When we look at the online environment, we don't see certain folks represented the way that others are. Questions about digital divides and who has access in terms of folks of color or people with certain levels of economic means and so forth. But I came to this very interested in a kind of a specific type of question, which had to do more with, you know, not do people do racist things on the internet, or can we find racist content on the internet? That seemed quite clear. I was looking for something more like, is there a way for us to think of the internet as being fundamentally racist? And if so, what does that look like? What does that mean? And how might I arrive at such a conclusion? And that's where I saw really no literature at that time.
I think let's turn to the book now, Black Software, because you've just released this great new book. I wonder, can you tell us what is Black Software about specifically and why is it so important?
Yes, Black Software is two things. And in the book, it really comes across as two stories. The first is that Black Software is a story about early Black technologists in the late 70s, the 80s, 90s, who really seized the computing and digital tools that we had available at that time and marshaled those tools, leveraged those tools to build computer-based networks of for, by, and representing Black people and Black interests. And so on one hand, Black Software is a sense in which we can think about tools, computing tools, digital tools, technology that serves the interests of that particular community and group. On the other hand, the other story that the book tells, excuse me, is Black Software in a more metaphorical way. And that is to think about the kinds of sinister ways historically that technology has been used to disrupt and thwart the threat that Black people have posed to America and really the world's racial order, that order of white supremacy. And so part of the book is also about Black Software in terms of that, the ways, the very dark ways, the very deleterious ways that technology has been used against us.
So I imagine then that all of the work that you just described at the beginning of the interview regarding Black Lives Matter and the ways that social movements build and manifest online, I imagine that it was this that really informed the beginning of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, part of my work on all fronts, especially for the book, has been, you know, we know racial injustice, we know racial justice activism. It's been around for a long time. If we try to understand the intersection between the two, then the question really becomes where in a digital space, on an online platform, do I look for sort of corollaries to these things? And so that's where, that's where I began to look. But I have to say, I was It was surprising to me in terms of what I found, and finding what I did not expect to find. And that is, I went out searching for a very easy answer to, or not an easy answer, but at least an answer that I thought might be somewhat predictable to a question that was fairly narrow and explainable. And one that was historically limited, meaning I figured I might end up talking about something that was a 3-year phenomenon, maybe 50 at the largest sort of range, maybe a 20-year time frame if we go back to the early internet. But ultimately, the book ended up going way back to 1960 in the formative years of both civil rights and computing. And that's when, you know, the book took a little bit of a different turn. And what was behind ultimately the book being framed as two books in one, two stories about two different types of black software.
And that's really fascinating, because then the book, it's, and I know, of course, it's very much written on the cover, but the book really is a historical book as well as a critique of what's currently happening and looking at current social networks and the way that these networks kind of manifest around black people and racial issues and racial injustice online.
Right. And, you know, and in a way, that's, you know, one of the kind of first principles I started with, which is understanding the way that networks form, both offline, interpersonal kinds of networks, professional networks, but also then digital networks. And so that was one of the first instances to me when I said, you know, look, here is a movement like Black Lives Matter that's been able to raise persistent attention to these issues using primarily digital tools and platforms. And so the very first work I did was trying to understand how those networks formed within Black Lives Matter on platforms, particularly like Twitter. But the other thing that told me, as I was still seeking this answer and explanation for how Black Lives Matter came to be, how did it become so successful, it was very clear that the networks we saw in the present were very much connected further and further back into the past with both other people and with other times. And what I mean by that was there was a moment where I said, here is a group of people who are using technology in such a successful way, such a facility with the technology itself, such an understanding of how networks work, how information spreads, how contagions spread in digital online networks. And that just doesn't come from nowhere. People don't just decide to one day open up a Twitter account and all of a sudden start producing content that is viral and connected and draws the attention of the world. So that's where I said, you know, this has to come from somewhere, meaning there were roots with other people, other movements, other times. And that's what began my journey backwards that ends up in the early 90s, then the 80s and late 70s, and then ultimately back in the 60s where I decided to begin.
I think the rise of digital networks around social movements, particularly as you're saying, how they mimic viruses is absolutely fascinating. But I'm interested to know whether the internet really became a safe space for black people and also for other marginalized communities and social movements, whether it was a safe space to speak and to express dissent and to safely discuss all of the issues that the black community was coming up with, or whether the traditional power structures as we understand them and as that came through the research, whether these traditional power structures maintained, and whether the voices of dissent and of protest, whether they were drowned out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And, you know, I think the answer is really, by and large, no, there has not been a safe space. And so if we go back to the late 80s, early 90s, and just the very dawn of the web, there was a moment, and that moment was in that intervening time between the kind of bulletin board systems, the way we did computer networking then, the news groups and so forth, and then what ultimately becomes Tim Berners-Lee's World Wide Web. And I think it was in that moment where Black people of color, marginalized folks saw an opportunity to build communities in those platforms that were safe, communities where everyone knew they were talking about each other's own interests, had each other's back, so to speak. And to a certain degree, that persisted in the first few years of the web when you had your walled gardens like AOL, and one could build a community within AOL that was sort of self-selecting in a way and create a kind of safe space. But even during that time, and the book, I talk a lot about the sort of formation of some early Usenet news groups and how there was conversation very specifically on those about, should we form a news group about African-American interests? And the overwhelming answer was yes. And there were all kinds of community standards and rules and a very kind of idyllic democratic way of deciding how this group was going to work. And then ultimately the group starts, and the first things you start to see are the same old prejudices and discrimination about people of color that are raised, the flame wars, if you remember those, that terminology, the flaming, the language, the offensive interactions. So that's been there from the beginning. And I think what we've seen, both in this shorter period of the web and certainly over the long history, 50 years now, of the internet, is that it has become the space in which we live our lives, almost every facet of our lives. And because of such, it has become the place that also manifests the same structures of racial discrimination, prejudice, and so forth. And so I think that's what, unfortunately, our internet has become over this time.
And I guess it's just a microcosm of life before the internet, right? That the same power structures, I guess, that created this system have just become, they've just been mapped onto, they've just recreated themselves in the digital space.
Indeed. And that, that's taken a little bit of time, but one can see the very specific evolution. I remember a lot of the folks that I talked to for the book, talking about how this transition from, the bulletin board era, the newsgroups era, to the World Wide Web, and then from the World Wide Web to a more commercialized web, that as those things evolved, you start to see the structures grow for what the parameters online are going to be, how it's going to be governed, what kind of content is going to thrive, how much it's going to cost, who's going to be visible and invisible. And many, and probably most of the folks that I talk to say, there was a moment, and, that moment pretty much ended about the late 1990s. As the structures offline began to really creep into and ultimately define online life.
One of the things that you speak about at length in the book is the idea that the Black Civil Rights Movement online really became a threat to white hegemony and white influence online. And I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit more, because it was also, because you also said at the beginning of the interview that the Black Lives Matter movement was really the watershed moment in the, it was almost, you know, the apex of Black influence online. So I'm wondering if you can just square that.
Yeah, it's, you know, there are two, you know, interesting connecting points. And so if we go back to the 1960s for the beginning, where we had a dynamic of places like IBM, the absolute leader in computing and computing development at the time. So they're out and they're marketing their new computing systems and so forth, and they frame what they have as a system that can solve problems. In fact, that's IBM's brand. We solve problems. Well, what was our problem in the 1960s when we think about a national scope? And our president, President Johnson at the time, very clearly defined our number one problem as the problem of crime, which was a problem really of the urban areas, which manifests as a problem essentially of Black people. And Johnson asked, how can we use computers to solve this particular problem, which was a very specific racial problem? And fast forward to the end of that, by 1965, 66, you get the first uses of this computers solving the problem, quote unquote, of crime. And what those systems ended up being were the beginnings of racial profiling systems, systems that were meant to over-police, criminalize Black people, Black neighborhoods. Fast forward all of these years, and what you see today is the massive fruition of that original project when we look around and see the types of predictive policing technologies and facial recognition technologies and so forth. And so this has been that 50 plus year project begun at that moment when civil rights and development of computing had that first clash. And that manifests then in a Black Lives Matter movement where you have activists and journalists and citizens using this platform to do all the great things that they did. But it wasn't too long before law enforcement got a hold of the platform, infiltrated the platform, used that to infiltrate the activist network, ultimately to find, arrest, in some cases, jail folks that were in these activist networks. And so that's how this continuously then manifest. And the issue from beginning till end is one of control. And so we can seize these technologies, we can use them for very specific purposes in terms of liberation and racial justice, but we don't own them by and large. And so we don't get to determine when they're available and what ways. And as soon as someone wants to co-opt or lock down that technology, then we're out of luck.
And you know, we're framing this discussion around one single movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, but it's a lot more, I would say, latent, this kind of technology, especially when we're talking about things like bias in AI or algorithmic bias. This kind of technology is being used, and particularly within a Black software context, this is just being used all the time, every single day, without our knowledge or consent.
Absolutely. And I think that is the more sinister, because it's what we can't see. What we can't see, we don't know to try to fight, and can't really fight it. And so the more insidious kinds of software, as the ones you mentioned, are deleterious because we end up in a way that we don't know about them and so can't do anything about it. Or even if we do know about them and have some kind of awareness, there's very little that we can do. And so not being a technologist, perhaps, or not being a technologist who has insight into a particular proprietary software system, or all of these layers of access, we're on the outside of looking in, and more often than not, really having to acquiesce before ever having been asked the question about, do we want this tool? Do we want this service? How does this work? Who does it hurt? Who does it serve? Whose interests are furthered? All of that happens outside of our awareness, and then we're left to deal with the consequences.
I think my very last question for you then is, because this is absolutely fascinating, is with your historical context that you've spent the last 5 years cultivating with this book, are you optimistic for the future with regards to, you know, with regards to this black software framework that you've created?
You know, I go back and forth. So there are a lot of times, it often depends on what part of this book I spend my time thinking about, the first or the second. But I have to say that, you know, I think where I've come down is optimism that's not based on the fact of some sense of technological utopianism or any kind of idealism about people suddenly and magically changing over the night in terms of their racial attitudes and so forth. I think what we see throughout the historical record is a constant struggle, a constant back and forth where new technologies are made for one purpose, used by others, often the marginalized, those who don't have a voice, for different purposes to help pursue their interests. Those in power take back control of those technologies and the process repeats. And I think we are generally okay so long as we are able to and continue to struggle. I worry when we begin not doing that. So I'm optimistic to the degree that I see every day on digital platforms and in many ways folks talking about issues of algorithmic bias, pushing back on platforms about how it is they cultivate the communities that are on their platforms, as I see people challenge and hold people account on places like Twitter, even if that's very thin, kind of what folks call as call-out culture and so forth. I see that struggle, and that struggle makes me optimistic that things will continue to be an open question, that things will continue to change and shift in small increments, though I'm not idealistic about any of this or thinking that this is something that will change dramatically in the short term.
Fantastic. Professor McIlwain, where can people find out more about you and your work and connect with you and, of course, buy the book?
Indeed. You can always go to charltonmcilwain.com. You can connect with me on Twitter at CMCILWAIN. You can buy the book anywhere you like to buy books, Amazon, independent bookstores, anywhere that you like to buy books, and certainly directly from Oxford University Press, who published the book.
That's fantastic. Well, Charlton McIlwain, thank you so much for spending time with us today and taking us through your new book, Black Software, which is really fantastic. I wish you all the very best with it.
Thank you so much, and thanks again for having me.